Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Well, as we round out another season, I have to be quite honest with you. This one was quite a challenge to finish. You'll notice that this season will only be 8 episodes. This is due in part to the season that I have planned coming up. Next season is going to focus on an EMP attack here in the United States, outlining everything from the initial warning signs to the attack itself, and what society would resemble once this attack occurs. This upcoming season is going to take quite a bit of research and production, as I am planning to have much longer episodes with a much higher production value. The planned release for these new episodes will be May 2024. I want to thank each of you for the immense amount of support that has been received this season. Once again, we have continued to grow, and while this show is still very small in comparison to other podcasts out there, none of them are covering what this show does, and that's okay. I'm not out seeking to be the largest show on any platform. My ultimate goal is to increase awareness of disasters that occur around us every day. If that's what you want to continue to hear, then stick around, because we are going to continue that. I do apologize for the gap in episodes this season, but work has recently become very busy, requiring more travel. This will be remedied by the launch of next season, as it will allow me time to pre-record and schedule posts to ensure a timely launch window. Now, I have a great episode planned for this week, so please sit back, relax, and enjoy. Do you want to help the show continue to grow? Well, have you considered joining the Destination Disaster Patreon page? If you choose to join, no matter which level, you'll gain access to an exclusive group where you can chat with other members, gain access to merchandise discounts, and a monthly AMA where we can all gather and discuss different topics. The Community Responder tier, or the entry-level tier, is $5 per month. Here, you'll gain access to the private Patreon community, monthly AMAs, a Patreon shoutout, and an exclusive sticker once you complete your first month's billing cycle. The next tier is the Section Chief, or $10 tier. Here, you'll gain access to all previous tier benefits, and will also gain a 20% discount on merch, 4 free Destination Disaster stickers, and an exclusive coffee mug once you complete your first month's billing cycle. And finally, we have the Emergency Management Director, or $20 tier. Here, you'll gain all benefits from the previous two tiers. You'll also receive an exclusive Destination Disaster merchandise bundle, hand-selected by myself, and a long-sleeve shirt that is not available on the show's store page. Please know that there is no obligation, and you can choose to end your support after a month if you choose to do so. Any amount of support is greatly appreciated. Please know that there is also a 7-day free trial where you can just gain access to the community to see if this is something that you want to support. Please consider joining today. This week, we're traveling to the time following World War II, a time where we see a massive population expansion, industrial growth, and the eventual evolution of the United States into a global superpower, all while Europe and Japan lay in ruins. Service members were returning in droves with pockets full of money and an itching to spend it on anything. Industries that once created machines to deal death and destruction had to quickly adapt and shift into peacetime production. Automation and distribution were king as those industries began to utilize early robots, forklifts, and distribution networks to increase access to customer goods across the country. According to the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, the private economy boomed as the government sector stopped buying munitions and hiring soldiers. Factories that had once made bombs now made toasters, and toaster sales were rising. On paper, measured GDP did drop after the war. It was 13% lower in 1947 than in 1944, but this was a GDP accounting quirk, not an indication of a stalled private economy or of economic hardship. A pre-war appliance factory converted to munitions production, when sold to the government for $10 million in 1944, added $10 million to measured GDP. The same factory converted back to civilian production might make 1 million toasters in 1947 that sold for $8 million, adding only $8 million to GDP. Americans surely saw the necessity for making bombs in 1944, but just as surely are better off when those resources are used to make toasters. More to the point, growth in private spending continued unabated despite a bean-counting decline in GDP. And arguably, life was good here in the United States. With industry and the economy booming, it was time to make babies. And when I tell you that people were making babies, just wait until you hear the staggering numbers that I'm about to tell you. In the years following the war, the population experienced rapid growth. A lesson provided by the Khan Academy outlines that the baby boom that we all know actually started much earlier and lasted far longer than most researchers initially believed. The first stirrings of the baby boom became evident as early as 1942 when the historically low birth rates of the Great Depression began to turn around with the birth of furlough babies during World War II. It wasn't until 9 months after the war's end, however, that the boom began in earnest. Before demobilization, only about 200,000 babies were born in the United States per month, but by the end of 1946, that figure had increased to nearly 350,000 babies. 20% more babies were born in 1946 than in 1945. By 1947, the number of live births per 1,000 population jumped to 26.6. But the baby boom just wasn't a spike in births after the end of World War II. The elevated American fertility rate continued for another 18 years. On average, 4.25 million babies were born per year between 1946 and 1964, when birth rates finally began to decline again. In 1964, the 76.4 million babies born during the baby boom generation constituted a whopping 40% of the U.S. population, which was then about 192 million. To combat this rapid rise in population, cities were breaching at the seams, unable to build new apartments fast enough. This period in time also coincides with these young families fanning out into new suburban developments that sprang up outside of nearly every major metropolitan area here in the United States. As suburban growth continued to grow, homes were built mass production style. One great example of this is the small town of Levittown, New York. Levittown went from a potato field to a community of 82,000 people in less than a decade. Construction proceeded according to 27 distinct steps, from pouring a concrete slab foundation to spray painting the drywall. Trees were planted every 28 feet. Every house in the division had exactly the same floor plan. Residents reported that at night, they sometimes walked into the wrong house by accident. With all of these cost-saving measures, the earliest Levittown houses were only $7,000 or a $29 per month mortgage, compared to the going rate of $90 per month for an apartment in the city. Now, I don't know if you've seen the movie Vivarium, but when I think of these suburbs, this movie comes to mind. If you haven't seen it, I highly encourage you to watch it. Now, prior to the war ending, purchasing a home was conducted in a far different manner than what we are all used to today. Most realtors required at least 50% of the home's value be put down prior to moving in to secure a mortgage, something a vast majority of the American population could not afford to do. Following the war, before the FHA, would-be homeowners had to put down an average of 58% of a home's purchase price to secure a mortgage, a nearly impossible prospect for working-class families. Since the GI Bill insured veterans' mortgages, Levittown could afford to offer them unprecedented credit, in some cases allowing veterans and their families to move in without putting down a cent. Home ownership suddenly became possible for a broader segment of the American population than ever before. The golden age of American culture was inevitably in full swing here at this time. However, the same can't be said for the war-ravaged Europe. Life in post-war Europe was hell on earth. To provide a bit of context to the numbers I'm about to share with you, the global population in 1940 was estimated to be around 3.8 billion people. While casualty estimates vary wildly, a general consensus is that roughly 85 million military and civilian casualties, or 3% of the population, lost their lives as a result of this war. Many of the world's wealthiest cities, including Berlin, Prague, Dresden, and Tokyo, were reduced to rubble. Every industrial country, except the United States, came out of the war with its resources, agriculture, and manufacturing largely destroyed. In the abnormally frigid winter of 1945 to 1946, once prosperous citizens starved. Those fortunate enough to survive confronted a future of suffering and fear. The end of the war was little cause for celebration, even among the victors. With the threat of communism now knocking at the door of the United States and allies in Eastern Europe, it was imperative that Europe reunite, and more importantly, rebuild to prevent the spread of communist ideals. Industries were once again called to support an effort that would become known as the Marshall Plan. Ports along the coastline of the United States loaded any and all supplies onto once mothballed Liberty-class supply vessels for transit across the Atlantic. This is where our episode brings us today. When the United States entered World War II, there was not enough cargo vessels to support the massive logistics effort that was needed to ferry supplies across the Atlantic. Under the Emergency Shipbuilding Act, the United States industrial capacity once again expanded, building Liberty-class cargo vessels. In total, 2,710 of these vessels were built throughout 17 shipyards around the country. Following the war, many of these vessels were inactivated to what is known as the Reserve Fleet. However, with the immense effort of needing to rebuild Europe, the United States relinquished command of 32 vessels to the French Line, a French company that served a vital role in helping to rebuild France. In order to replace the large number of cargo ships lost in the war, the company notably received a total of 32 Liberty ships. The French government also funded the building of some freighters. For the reconstruction of France, and in particular of its ports, the transit transported many tons of freight. The transport of goods became its main activity in this period. One port that served as a vital lifeline between the U.S. and France was the port of Texas City, Texas. This port handled various types of cargo from petroleum to consumer goods and agricultural compounds such as ammonium nitrate. This compound has a wide variety of uses from explosives to fertilizers and even antibiotics. On the morning of April 16, 1947, longshoremen loading cargo in the holds of the SS Grand Camp noticed heat and smoke emanating from the section where ammonium nitrate had been stored in warmer conditions that is believed to have increased its chemical activity. The ammonium nitrate, needed either as fertilizer or an explosive, was manufactured in Nebraska and Iowa and shipped to Texas City by rail before being loaded onto the Grand Camp. It was manufactured in a patented process mixed with clay, petrolatum, rosin, and paraffin wax to avoid moisture caking. It was packaged in paper sacks, then transported and stored at higher temperatures that increased its chemical activity. Longshoremen reported that the bags were warm to the touch before loading. Upon receiving this report from those longshoremen, the captain of the SS Grand Camp immediately ordered the crew off the ship and to seal the cargo hatches in an attempt to smother the suspected fire that was growing within. On April 16, 1947, at around 8 a.m., smoke was spotted in the cargo hold of the Grand Camp while she was moored. Longshoremen used a gallon jug of water and two fire extinguishers, but they had zero effect and the cargo hold continued to fill with smoke. The longshoremen were then ordered to leave. At this point, the captain of Grand Camp ordered that no water be used, lest the cargo be ruined. Instead, he ordered all hatches sealed and the hold to be filled with steam in an attempt to smother the fire. This was unlikely to be effective, as ammonium nitrate is an oxidizer, thus neutralizing the extinguishing properties of steam. The steam may have contributed to the fire by converting the ammonium nitrate to nitrous oxide while augmenting the already intense heat in the ship's hold. 30 minutes later, the pressure grew so great that the sealed hatches blew off the ship, leading to a large cloud of yellow-orange smoke to leak into the sky. The strange colored smoke drew the attention of citizens from the town, as most gathered at the water's edge, watching this odd colored smoke billow into the sky. Roughly 45 minutes later, the heat and pressure reached the necessary combination to detonate. At 9:12 a.m., the Grand Camp detonated, sending out a pressure and heat wave that caused the destruction in a 2,000-foot radius. In addition to the fireball that rocketed throughout the port, the explosive force caused a 15-foot tsunami that led to catastrophic damage to the port. Flying shrapnel resulted in ignition of refineries and chemical tanks along the waterfront. Falling bales of burning twine from the Grand Camp's cargo added to the damage, and her anchor was hurled across the city. Two sightseeing airplanes nearby were blown out of the sky, while 10 miles away, half of the windows in Galveston were shattered. The explosion blew almost 6,350 short tons, or 5,760 tons, of the ship's steel into the air, some at supersonic speed. This explosion left 1,000 buildings completely destroyed and resulted in a chemical plant operated by the Monsanto Company to collapse, killing nearly 150 of its 450 workers. Volunteer firefighting teams that had initially responded to the fire of the SS Grand Camp were completely decimated, with the exception of one survivor. Official casualty estimates came to a total of 567, including all the crewmen who remained aboard Grand Camp. All but one member of the 28-man Texas City Volunteer Fire Department were killed in the initial explosion on the docks while firefighting the shipboard fire. With fires raging throughout Texas City, first responders from other areas were initially unable to reach the site of the disaster. Oh, but it doesn't end there. This explosion resulted in the nearby ship, the SS Highflyer, to be freed from its moorings, where it would come to rest against the SS Wilson B. Keene. Two crew members assigned to the SS Highflyer had returned to the ship to search for survivors. While searching, the two men identified another fire in the cargo hold of this ship. They noted that her cargo was ablaze and reported it to someone at the harbor front. This message seems to have gone unheard for several hours until it was realized that this indicated a serious problem. Only around 11 p.m. did tugboats attempt to pull Highflyer away from the docks. Despite having cut her anchor, they were unable to move her. This would last around 2 hours until around 1:10 a.m. when another explosion, this time far larger than the initial one, rocked Texas City once again. Prior to the explosion, the heat of the Highflyer had grown so high that the hull of the ship glowed red hot. Thankfully, the port had been evacuated by this point, so the risk to life was much lower. According to witnesses, the explosion was more powerful than that of Grand Camp. Casualties were light, since the docks had already been evacuated, but the second explosion exacerbated the damage to nearby ships and buildings. The blast destroyed the nearby Wilson B. Keene. The steel frame of Highflyer had been heated until glowing, and these chunks rained down upon Texas City, setting mass fires. One of the propellers was blown off and subsequently found nearly a mile inland. In the subsequent hours, local area hospitals became quickly inundated. 5,000 wounded would show up to 21 area hospitals, with nearly 1,800 needing admitted. There were so many deaths that local morgues were incapable of supporting this influx of death. In order to allow for proper identification, the dead were brought to the local high school gym where families could identify those bodies. Of the dead, 405 were identified, and 63 have never been identified. The latter remains were placed in a memorial cemetery in the north part of Texas City near Moses Lake. An additional 113 people were classified as missing, for no identifiable parts were ever found. This figure includes firefighters who were aboard Grand Camp when she exploded. There's some speculation that there were hundreds more killed, but uncounted, including visiting seamen, undocumented laborers and their families, and an untold number of travelers. More than 800 people were left orphaned or widowed. Property damage-wise, the scale of this disaster led it to be classified as the worst industrial accident in United States history. Figures vary greatly, as it was challenging to quantify this damage. $100 million in property damage is the general consensus, equivalent to over $1 billion in damage today. In addition to that, $500 million in oil products burned, or $5.1 billion in today's currency. The cause of the explosions have never been fully identified. Some believe that an incorrectly discarded cigarette is to blame. However, this could have been prevented had crews correctly stored the ammonium nitrate and raised concern when they noticed the heat rising from the bags during the initial loading phase. In reality, the cause is human error. In addition to this, the loading of ammonium nitrate was strictly prohibited at this port, yet was allowed to continue anyways. While most of these disasters that we have covered throughout the season have received national attention, I don't think any of those included a fundraiser ran by a member of an organized crime family. One of the largest fundraising efforts for the city and the victims of the disaster was organized by Sam Maceo, one of the two brothers who ran organized crime in the Galveston area at the time. Maceo organized a large-scale benefit on the island, featuring entertainers including Phil Harris, Frank Sinatra, and Ann Sheridan. In the end, the Texas City Relief Fund raised more than $1 million, or $13.9 million in today's terms. Payouts for fire insurance claims reached nearly $4 million, or $51.8 million in today's terms. Within days of the disaster, major companies that had lost facilities in the explosions announced plans to rebuild Texas City, and in some cases, to expand their operations. Some companies implemented policies of retaining all of the hourly workers who had previously worked at destroyed facilities, with plans to use them in the rebuilding. Cost estimations of the industrial reconstruction were estimated at approximately $100 million, or $1.31 billion adjusted for inflation. In the following years, litigation against the United States began to arise as those affected began demanding compensation for damages and lost loved ones. Most of these cases were grouped into the Elizabeth Dalhite et al. Versus the United States. This lawsuit emerged in 1950, just after the Federal Tort Claims Act of 1946, which allowed citizens to pursue legal matters against the United States. On April 13, 1950, the district court found the United States government responsible for a litany of negligent acts of omission and commission by 168 named agencies and their representatives in the manufacture, packaging, and labeling of ammonium nitrate. This was further compounded by errors in transit, storage, loading, fire prevention, and fire suppression, all of which led to the explosions and the subsequent carnage. On June 10, 1952, the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned this decision, finding that the United States maintained the right to exercise its own discretion in vital national matters. The U.S. Supreme Court affirmed that decision on June 8, 1953, in a 4-3 opinion, noting that the district court had no jurisdiction under the federal statute to find the government liable for negligent planning decisions, which were properly delegated to various departments and agencies. In short, the FTCA clearly exempts failure to exercise or perform a discretionary function or duty, and the court found that all of the alleged acts in this case were discretionary in nature. In its dissent, the three justices argued that, under the FTCA, Congress has defined the tort liability of the government as analogous to that of a private person. For example, when carrying out duties unrelated to governing. In this case, a policy adopted in the exercise of an immune discretion was carried out carelessly by those in charge of a detail, and that a private person would certainly be held liable for such acts. A private person is held to a higher standard of care when carrying out inherently dangerous acts such as transportation and storage of explosives. Luckily, the decision to appeal was granted by Congress, where legislation allowed for compensation to be awarded to those affected. By 1957, when the final claim had been paid, around $17 million had been awarded. In the end, the port did rebuild into the mammoth petroleum operation that we see today. Yet again, Texas City lies in extremely close proximity to the industrial area, where if another such disaster were to occur, it would result in devastating consequences for that entire community once again. I want to thank you all for listening this week. It's never easy to finish out a season, as I enjoy talking about these disasters that rarely receive the light of day once they have occurred. As I stated at the beginning of this season, the first episode of next season is aimed to be released in early May. I'm also aiming for these episodes to be at least 1 hour in length, allowing for much more granular detail. I want to thank my one lone Patreon subscriber, Thomas, for continuing to support the show at the highest tier level. Until next season, this is Devin signing off with Destination Disaster.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.